that has been made are after talking about the emergence of the spiritual man or the spiritual being as something that is beyond just the influence of a higher consciousness in the physical, vital, or mental realm, either as religion, occultism, or spiritual philosophy, a truly spiritual life which moves towards the experience of the spirit and makes that its preoccupation. He has turned his gaze upon the history of mankind with a question posed to this endeavor or possibility that what gains has it left for mankind? Does it hold any gains? Throughout the history, it has left very few traces. And this question may be asked if somebody is proposing that this is a desired goal for the future. The question may be asked, you know, why don't we just think of it as a freak possibility? Why should it be a desired goal? Since it has left so little of a trace in a very large, long sort of history of mankind. And that's what he's considering in these paragraphs that we are talking of now. Sri Aurobindo has treated this in a variety of ways. In earlier chapters, for example, in the refusal of the ascetic, he has treated the same problem in another way, in saying that, yes, it is true that those who have moved towards the spiritual impulse have tended to refuse the engagement with life, society, and matter, which has caused the split in Indian traditions of what is known as sannyasa and samsara. And in Western traditions, between what is known as the church and the state. So, to whatever extent, even that division between church and state is more a religion versus society division. But within that religious domain, that secluded domain of religion, of monastery, there have been examples of a prodigious spirituality, but these have been secluded lives, not lives that have ultimately meant much to the run of society. So this is what he takes up. Now, as I said elsewhere, he has looked at it in other ways by saying that this is not the best attitude that spirituality has taken, and in a way it has been diametrically opposed to a similar exclusivism of social life where society has been, in a sense, denying the spirit. Now, here he takes a slightly different stand. The stand he takes here is the refusal of the ascetic is justified by the fact that if life denies him the conditions for the emergence of the spirit, then he is justified in seeking those conditions in seclusion and in a refusal of life. So these beings who have been bold enough, courageous enough to exclude the domain of society, but moved, in an intense one-pointed manner towards the spirit, have been the forerunners of mankind. They have served nature's purpose, if not in its own time, but perhaps for the future, just by the very fact of affirming something that nobody else affirmed. So this is one way he's looking at it. The other thing he's saying in that chapter that we have, paragraph we have just considered, is that also it is not true that these beings have left no mark on human history or of society. They have left a mark both because a high spiritual achievement is also one which in some way, even without human beings knowing it, embraces the whole of mankind. It leans towards other human lives as part of its own. So this movement of consciousness, it may start off as an exclusive and individual movement, but it cannot but leave its mark in terms of meaning to help whoever is ready to accept the conditions and even to make those conditions possible for all who come into its orbit. So this has happened. Moreover, it has also left its mark as the creator of new aspirations in the human race. Mankind in its history has certainly developed greater and greater ideals, greater idealisms and aspirations. Whether mankind has been able to live by them is another matter. But all the same, these are the seeds that have been left in the journeying of the great seers and sages of the past. So we find that these things have been achieved, but humanity as a whole, in large, has not followed in its tracks, and therefore today it turns at the threshold of its evolution into a higher consciousness. It turns to these beings and asks in a voice of doubt whether they have anything to offer or not. Now the third aspect which Sri Aurobindo brings up with regard to this whole issue is about the mass, is about humanity at large. And here he's saying that the reason why these beings have not left a substantial mark in human history is that humanity has followed a much slower evolution, the evolution of cosmic nature. So just as we realize throughout, he's talking about these two evolutions that are going on. The evolution of nature, of Prakriti, and the evolution of the person, of Purusha. When we say the yoga of Prakriti and the yoga of Purusha. So in that sense, yoga of Prakriti in the human race, in the general human species, is still trying to integrate the vital, physical, vital and mental existence to bring it to a point where spirituality may become an emergent property in the mass. It has not yet happened. In other words, those who have achieved these things have done so before their time, in a sense. Perhaps now's the time. This is part of Sri Aurobindo's thesis that up until now, spirituality has been seen as an individual effort that few have been attracted towards. And if they were attracted towards it, they had to leave life and society to achieve it. But now, some kind of a connection between spirituality and humanity at large must take place. If the yoga of Prakriti, the yoga of nature in man, and the yoga of the emergence of spirituality of the Purusha is to find a meeting ground. So the question even arises at times when such a possibility is showing itself. Before this, even the question doesn't arise. Today, nature is beleaguered with problems where this possibility is something she moves towards. I think, in essence, this is, where we are right now. And we can proceed from here. Sri Aurobindo makes the point, though, that this emergence of the spirit is not per se a humanitarian or a social work, that it exists for itself, for the entry into a higher consciousness. And as far as humanity at large and society is concerned, it has to enter into contact with this only to the extent that those are open to it, aspire for it. So he says, to discover the spiritual being in himself is the main business of the spiritual man. And to help others towards the same evolution is his real service to the race. Till that is done, an outward help can suffer and alleviate, but nothing or very little more is possible.
There was just a...
Yes.
Yeah. So, from what you said, the last 10 minutes, the feeling I got was that in the life divine, at least, Sri Aurobindo is fairly sympathetic to the approach of the sannyasin who stays away from the samsara. That he is justified. That there are enough reasons to justify his way. Correct?
Yeah. In this particular chapter, at least, I would say yes. The answer is yes.
So
that's not the case in every place.
Yeah, exactly. That's
certainly the case over here, because he's looking at it in a historical fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And he is justifying the sannyasi from this viewpoint that life conditions not being amenable, it is a bold and courageous step to break out of life for the sake of the spirit. Yes.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, that's where I was reading. But the overall sense that we get, as quote-unquote the official, not official, and quote-unquote, the overall stand of Sri Aurobindo is more that he has been fairly unsympathetic to it. But I guess it's because that he's spoken about it in different ways at different places, correct?
Yeah, quite right. I think I quite agree with you. He has spoken about it in different ways in different places, and you may say that the impression that he is fairly unsympathetic towards this arises, particularly because he is talking from a contemporary standpoint, and however much we may say that the refusal of the ascetic was justified in the past, what the point he's making is that now the hour has changed. Now it is time to recognize the fact that spiritual solutions to social problems must be provided, not in the way that society wants or is used to wanting it, but in the way that true solutions can be found.
Yeah, thank you, Devashish. Shall we start reading the next paragraph then?
Yeah, sure.
Vince, would you like to read?
Sure. You can hear me okay?
Yeah, perfect.
Good. It is true that the spiritual tendency has been to look more beyond life than towards life. It is true also that the spiritual change has been individual and not collective. Its result has been successful in the man, but unsuccessful or only indirectly operative in the human mass. The spiritual evolution of nature is still in process and incomplete. One might almost say, still only beginning, and its main preoccupation has been to affirm and develop a basis of spiritual consciousness and knowledge, and to create more and more a foundation or formation for the vision of that which is eternal in the truth of the Spirit. It is only when nature has fully confirmed this intensive evolution in formation through the individual that anything radical of an expanding, a dynamically diffusive character can be accepted, can be expected, or any attempt at collective spiritual life. Such attempts have been made, but mostly as a field of protection for the growth of the individual's spirituality, acquire a successful permanence. For till then, the individual must be preoccupied with his own problem of entirely changing his mind and life into conformity with the truth of the Spirit, which he is achieving or has achieved in his inner being in knowledge. Any premature attempt at a large-scale collective spiritual life is exposed to vitiation by some incompleteness of the spiritual knowledge on its dynamic side, by the imperfections of the individual seekers, and by the invasion of the ordinary mind and vital and physical consciousness taking hold of the truth and mechanizing, obscuring, or corrupting it. The mental intelligence in its main power of reason cannot change the principal and persistent character of human life. It can only effect various mechanizations, manipulations, developments, and formulations. But neither is mind as a whole, even spiritualized, able to change it. Spirituality liberates and illumines the inner being. It helps mind to communicate with what is higher than itself, to escape even from itself. It can purify and uplift by the inner influence the outward nature of individual human beings. But so long as it has to work in human mass through mind as the instrument, it can exercise an influence on the earth life, but not bring about a transformation of that life. For this reason, there has been a prevalent tendency in the spiritual mind to be satisfied with such an influence, and in the main, to seek fulfillment in other life elsewhere, or to abandon altogether any outward-going endeavor and concentrate solely on individual spiritual salvation or perfection. A higher instrumental dynamism than mind is needed to transform totally a nature created by the ignorance.
Talking about nature's yoga and the fact that it isn't ready for the spiritual change so far. And what it has done is to try and develop.
I'm sorry, I can't hear. Devashish is breaking up. I'm sorry.
Hello.
Anybody else? Right now, yes. But yeah, before you were, I couldn't understand.
Yeah, just that you could.
Yeah, for me also, he's breaking up. Are you using the same?
Hello.
Yes, Devajda.
Hello.
Devajda, the first time when you start talking, you were breaking up a bit. So if you could start again.
Okay. Please let me know if I'm breaking up. I think I was hearing many of you are breaking up as well. So it may be the connection. But anyway, what I was saying is that here again, Sri Aurobindo is referring to the yoga of nature, which so far has not been ready for the emergence of spiritual consciousness. But in its forerunners has been experimenting with preparing the grounds for such an emergence. This is the point he's making, that so far it has taken one individual or another, and in that emergence of the spiritual consciousness, in these individuals, something has been achieved for nature in trying to establish a foundation. So this establishment of a foundation, see, this is the interesting thing about the whole enterprise, as Sri Aurobindo is spelling it out, is that there is a convergence taking place between the yoga of nature and the yoga of the Purusha. From the point of view of the yoga of the Purusha, these isolated individuals are those in whom the reversal of consciousness is occurring in an individual sense. The emergence of the spiritual man is taking place. But from the viewpoint of nature's yoga, these isolated examples in whom the reversal is taking place are serving its purpose as well. It's serving its purpose in its own experimental preparation for the coming of new species. So, in that, there is another aspect which is very interesting. He doesn't elaborate it here, but the mother talks about it, where she says that through history, nature has picked up in different cultures different aspects of spirituality, and these aspects have found their expression in the emergence of certain forms of spirituality in specific individuals. Now, they have left either the trace of a religion or some kind of mystic culture, culture of mysticism, which has developed around itself a certain spiritual path. So many spiritual paths have evolved as a result through the history of mankind. Now what happens with each of these paths is that they tend to fossilize into exclusivisms. Each one of these in time falls into general mass which is not prepared for it and holds on to it, clings to it as the only way to the spiritual life. But she is saying that from nature's point of view, these are all specific experiments that are leading to the integral man, or the leading to the emergence of the integral spiritual being. Therefore, from a certain point of view, it is useful to study the spiritual efforts of the past in all religions of the world, in all spiritual parts of the world, because each one of these is one of nature's experiments. And all of them belong to the integral development of spirituality. Nature's experiments take place over time. It's as if one being encompasses for the whole of history and all of space. See, all of space and all of time is one becoming. Therefore, all the specific becomings, both in space and in time, are part of one particular emergence, which is the emergence of the integral person. So that's why he says that these are all nature's establishment of the basis of the emergence of the spiritual being. So then only when nature has fully confirmed this intensive evolution and formation through the individual, that anything radical of expanding or dynamically diffuse of character can be expected, or any attempt at collective spiritual life acquire a successful permanence. And there again he's pointing to the fact that there have been collective spiritual lives, but these have been of a monastic nature. They have been basically protected domains, ashramas in that sense, the traditional ashrama, which has existed only to protect the spiritual life of the individual, not to open up an expressive life of the spiritual consciousness. Then the last part of this paragraph is very important, because he is again, to a large extent, justifying that conservative approach. in the sense that he's saying the individual has to go quite far before one can try to make some attempt to enter into some kind of collective expression. See, that the reason being that whatever instruments are available to mankind so far are inadequate for that change. And this message that he's giving is a message that Sri Aurobindo and the mother have acquired through hard experiment. See, Sri Aurobindo tried in many ways before, you know, 1914 and particularly before 1920 to influence mankind towards the spiritual life through a variety of powers, as we find in the record of yoga. That was part of his work, Karma Chatushtaya. One of the aspects of Karma Chatushtaya was the utilization of the siddhis of vijnana to influence activities on the earth, so as social conditions could become much greater for the emergence of spirituality. But at the same time, he's also refusing to jump into social life. Number of times people came to him asking him to return to politics. The clearest answer he gives is to his brother, where he says that if I were to return at this stage, it would be a matter of the blind leading the blind. The problem is that everybody is blind and they are happily leading each other. But the difference is that he knows that he is blind even in the height of his spiritual realization. And that's why he knows that it is insufficient power to try to lead people at this point. He says it will only create more trouble until he has achieved the goal for which he has set out. Now, what is that goal and why is it inadequate? That is what he's bringing out here. Firstly, he's saying mankind has tried throughout history to have some kind of control over the life of the mass using the powers of the human mind. That, in fact, is the whole history of civilization. Civilization, in a way, implies control of life by regulatory processes that are ethical and aesthetic, that have some power of goodness to it so that there is a certain amount of conformity to a higher ideal in society, and aesthetic in the sense that there is a openness to the finer things in society. That is what civilization tries to accomplish. But it can never fully accomplish this because of a very fundamental reason that Sri Aurobindo points out. Mind does not have full grasp of the vital and material consciousness. These forms of consciousness escape it. Therefore, it is always seen as a partial success, but at the same time an imposition on life. And life revolts at some point, and civilizations rise and fall as a result. That's the reason why every civilization is marked by its eventual demise. Now, the only possibility is if some kind of consciousness that is intimate with and includes in itself mental consciousness, vital consciousness, and material consciousness can form a harmony out of these, then such a social change can occur. So Sri Aurobindo is pointing out, not by the human mind of however inspired a genius or a number of geniuses, can we shape the conditions of a spiritual life in society. Secondly, not even by a possession of the spiritual ranges of mind, the ranges of cosmic mind above the human mind, which have led to all the religious teachers of today, or until today, is this possible? Because even rising to the overmind, it does not have that power over the vital and material consciousness. It has power to influence, but not power to transform. That's the point he's making over here, that spirituality liberates and illumines the inner being. It helps mind to communicate with what is higher than itself, to escape even from itself. It can purify and uplift by the inner influence, the outward nature of individual human beings. But so long as it has to work in the human mass, through mind as the instrument, it can exercise an influence on the earth life, but not bring about a transformation of that life. So that's the reason why, if a social change is to endure, it has to occur only at a certain critical point of spiritual development. Sri Aurobindo sees this in the last chapters of the Life Line as the Gnostic society, which occurs only at a very high stage of voluntary, you know, sort of collective formation by people who have risen to a very high consciousness. But we may also see another angle or another possibility in this, which is that if in a society there is a certain density of the psychic existence that emerges due to a few who live it and can, you know, stimulate it in others, bring it out in others, so that the social consciousness is created, which is primarily the psychic, then the action of a higher consciousness can find some kind of, you know, ground to express itself. He doesn't make this absolutely clear here, but certainly that hint is there, where he's saying that it is not by mind, though the mind is useful. There is an inner mental influence upon the inner nature that can take us forward, give us ideals, make us aspire. But the transformative power of something higher than mind can only find ground if in the mass there is a progress of consciousness that ultimately brings forward the psychic being in society itself. So he ends this paragraph by saying, so long as it has to work in the human mass through mind as an instrument, it can exercise influence on the earth life, but not bring about a transformation of that life. For this reason, there has been a prevalent tendency in the spiritual mind to be satisfied with such an influence. The sense of this is all that can be done. Okay, so let's leave this kind of aspiration in the earth atmosphere for the inner being to absorb, and in the main to seek fulfillment in other life elsewhere, to abandon altogether any outward going endeavor to concentrate only on an individual spiritual salvation or perfection. A higher instrumental dynamics and mind is needed to transform totally a life created in the ignorance.
Devashishta, I remember reading a letter in which he's essentially telling somebody that, you know, in the early stages, this yoga is pretty much the same as other yogas. It's only in the later stages that it really differentiates. Do you remember that letter, or can you speak to that? I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, essentially with this paragraph, he's kind of going in that same direction, that yes, the integration is there, but the integration shouldn't be attempted too early, correct?
Yes, no doubt. That's exactly what he's saying over here. Is, you know, whether it is the same as other yogas, I'm not sure. I don't recollect him saying that. But certainly this much he is making a point of, that the individual consciousness has to emerge as a spiritual consciousness. It can have, I don't think he's saying, denying the possibility that a higher spiritual consciousness should not have an influence on the inner being of its, kind of surroundings, of its environment. But still, even if it attempts that, it is not enough. And it is only from both sides, if in the mass there is the emergence of a deeper or greater consciousness, and if in the individuals there is the descent of a higher than mind consciousness, then only can the true fulfillment of transformed ignorant nature take place in society.
In this paragraph, the end portion especially, what if we put the other aspect of that one man's perfection can save the world? Like, say, when he's talking about this individual exercise and purification, where mind is actually communicating with what is higher than itself, purify and uplift by the inner influence and all that. So, I mean, mind at its sincere state, actually its tendency is to actually look up to something higher than itself, right? It is the insincere state where it feels itself as the boss. Now, I'm saying if one individual can manage to actually be perfect in the nature of whatever has been provided to that individual, and so does it not apparently contradict?
I think it doesn't contradict. But you see, one man's perfection yet can change the world, I think, is a very good example. What happens, what he's saying there, we were talking about the individuals who have attained to some kind of spiritual realization and have left an influence on the earth of that in the inner consciousness, have had an inner influence on human beings. But he's saying that is not enough. Now, that one man's perfection yet can save the world is the integral realization. The integral realization, if that occurs, it has not yet occurred. I mean, I'm not talking about Sri Aurobindo and the mother. I'm talking about the history of mankind till now, where we've got different aspects of spiritual realization. Now, if all this can be summed up in a single human being who can, as a result, can rise to integral consciousness, then that integral consciousness, expressing itself through mind, life and body, starts having an influence on matter, on life, at the cosmic level as well. Now, this is exactly what Sri Aurobindo felt. That's why it becomes possible to think of an integral yoga of one person or two persons, Sri Aurobindo and the mother, as laying the conditions for a spiritual age. He doesn't make it very explicit here, because otherwise it would seem as a very, kind of a ambitious statement being made by one person. But in fact, that is what makes it possible, that, the emergence of the integral human, even in one person, makes it possible for that influence in the mass to occur, this supramental influence, which can actually intimately remold matter, life and mind in the cosmos. See, so that is the way in which invisibly even the solution that Sri Aurobindo came up with, when I was saying that up until 1920 or so, he was still looking for ways by which he could influence the inner nature of the cosmos. He sort of abandoned those ways by 1920 or so. And he sought purely to bring down the supermind, because he saw that that embodiment of the supermind, bringing it into the body, was the solution to the transformed human nature at the cosmic level also, not merely at the individual level.
So it seems that real difference is that between doing, having mind as the tool and this, is that mind can communicate with what is higher than itself, say even to supermind, but it cannot, I mean, the embodiment of supermind has to be in a different way. It is not just our mind's aspiration, it has to involve everything.
And indeed, it has to, exactly. Mind cannot be a mediator alone with supermind. Mind has to be transformed and bring supermind into the vital and the physical. That embodiment of the supermind is necessary as the influence that can transform. See, it's no longer an influence, but it becomes an agent for transformation.
But mind can be the starting point, though.
Surely, mind can be the starting point. And, you know, this is the thing about the integral yoga. There can be many starting points. But mind can certainly be a starting point. In Sri Aurobindo's own case, mind was the starting point. And in fact, it is by mind of, or rising in consciousness into the realms of cosmic mind and ultimately beyond them into supermind, that he did the journey of contacting that consciousness and bringing it down. In the process, he opened up all the other forms of consciousness. But, you know, also one may proceed along another line, which is the easier way that he found for in general. And the mother found, you know, she's the one who really taught that way, which is the bringing to the front of the psychic being. So it is both these, I think, which are very powerful. The ascent of the mental consciousness and the emergence of the psychic being. These are two very powerful means by which that third process of the embodiment of supermind can become possible.
Actually, it's also another thing I'm thinking that, you know, this mind, vital, body, they're so, intimately connected that even if one thing is very sincere, it actually finds that it has to integrate all, otherwise it hits a roadblock.
Yeah, because sincerity ultimately is coming from the psychic presence in mind or vital or physical is what gives it the sincerity or the urge or aspiration for the spiritual life. Now, problem is, of course, what you're saying is true. If the aspiration for the integral consciousness is there sufficiently, because presence of the psychic is sufficiently strong, then it will want to include the other parts. But just as he's saying over here, it is also possible that you hit that roadblock and accept it. Many people have done that, and that has been the way of the past. That people have hit that roadblock and said, this is what spirituality is. We can only go this far. And beyond that, whatever is to be achieved outside of life.
Well, that can be called as one kind of insincerity also, right? Because accepting a roadblock means it does not satisfy the initial call.
I don't know whether initial call was strong enough in that, you see, one thing I have to say in terms of sincerity and insincerity are also conditioned by nature's yoga. Nature may think that this is sincere right now. Mankind has not always been given to see the whole, the truth. Otherwise, you would say that, you know, even supermind is not the end. In today's world, supermind is the sincerity, the call of sincerity. But in the past, something else may have been the highest that nature afforded to somebody.
Right, but that is when you are actually arriving there. Meaning, I'm saying somebody is at some point and then accepts there itself that this is my culmination. That is what I'm talking about, because that is not really satisfying the initial call, which started from some point. I mean, it may not be strong enough. That, I mean, actually, these are just terms of whether sincerity or strength or whatever power. I mean, sincerity itself is a power. That from that perspective.
Yeah, you see, the problem with this kind of thing is that we are assuming that human beings are all the same throughout history, but this is not the case. Sri Aurobindo has made the case that spiritual people of the past were not necessarily, you know, any kind of less than what they were meant to do. Whatever they had to experience, that initial call that you are talking about was itself just that much. You see, the psychic aspiration itself is something which ends at a certain point. That is the adhikar. Adhikarvad comes from that. It is only with the evolution of that that the psychic call grows to the point where it can conceive of the integral human.
Okay. Actually, I was also thinking, like, for example, if you think of a child, like a baby, he sort of has to integrate all the things in order to even take one step further, right? Like body, nerves, mind, the effort, which you may say vital. So it is like, where does this bifurcation takes place, where it actually forgets to integrate or sort of accepts the non-integrated?
Well, actually, you see, I mean, your point is very, it's a very deep point, because it's true that even from childhood there is an attempt to integrate, but it is a partial attempt. The attempt is made by the ego to make an amalgam of mind, life and body, which we call ourselves, while there are big gulfs underneath which are not integrated. That's why we have problems of the you know, different parts of the nature which are conflicting with one another. So that's why he's talking about psychic being that can integrate some of these to some extent. Now, where does the problem bifurcation come? The bifurcation is ultimately an evolutionary bifurcation. It arises because evolution takes place discontinuously. We have inside ourselves discontinuities. Physical consciousness is discontinuous with vital consciousness. Vital consciousness is discontinuous with mental consciousness. So each of these by itself is different. And that's why probably you're right, that there is a need felt to integrate them. But that need, you know, in its very depths, has somehow not been affirmed. Even just like any animal, that need is not strong enough for even the aspiration to seek for that kind of integration. So in mankind also, as far as the psychic being is concerned, that psychic being, from the psychic entity to the psychic being, and its emergence as the power that will integrate mind, life and body, has only emerged over history, over time. Prior to that, it was an acceptance that only a compromise between these three is sufficient amount of integration.
So, basically, so there are two things. One is that hitting a roadblock and cannot do anything about it. Like, we are all, I'm sure, in different states of that kind. Like, oh, I don't know. I mean, there is a problem I can see, but I don't know what to do about it other than praying. So, and you dwell on that, in that state for a while. But that is like an incapacity that you can see for yourself. But this is spirituality. Declaring that into myself is something that I'm addressing. Or this is the maximum that anybody can go. That declaration is something which I'm opposing to.
Yeah. Now the thing is, whether it indeed is declared in that form or not, I don't know. But maybe, actually, Sri Aurobindo has something to say about that too. I'm remembering. He's saying that some of the spiritual experience has such an overwhelming reality that until and unless, again, it's the same thing about nature, nature's yoga. Until and unless this particular kind of consciousness has been integrated into nature, the early forerunners with the slightest amount of spiritual experience are apt to think this is as far as it goes. It can't go any further. See? So then they declare that finality. Now, with time, mankind, nature also evolves, mankind also evolves, and that which was experienced to be the furthest limit is seen not to be so much the furthest limit, but that it can be kept open, you see. So this is how history has proceeded, actually. The history of spirituality, sir. Actually, there's an interesting, you mentioned this, there's an interesting metaphor that Sri Ramakrishna gives to this this thing of the spiritual experience. He says that spiritual capacity in an individual is different, and depending on the spiritual capacity, how much you can bear before you fall into that Turiya state and declare that this is as far as we can go is different. So he says, you know, it's like he had a vision, and he explains that vision. He says, I saw that there was a mountain of sugar, and there were ants that were each going and picking up some of the grains of sugar and walking back. But because they were ants, each grain of sugar was too big for it. The smaller ants could take only one, and then they were vibrating like crazy and falling down under the weight, while bigger ones could take one or two. See? Then he says that this is the story of human spiritual capacity. If your capacity is a certain amount, you experience a certain amount and then feel that it can't go any further than this. But if your capacity grows with time, and then you can see more as well and realize that, no, this was only a little bit of that mountain that can be experienced.
Yeah, maybe. It's just probably mentally I'm trying to comprehend that how can a grain of sugar can translate in a clear fashion to the whole mountain. That is what I was probably opposing, or it's just logically, I mean, it said that since Ramakrishna is saying that there is a mountain, maybe you can say, well, the ants don't see the mountain. They just can touch and one grain and feel just one grain is there, or two grains are, or maybe a little more, but not really see the mountain.
They can't
but
see
I'm
them.
Saying, yeah, but the thing is, seeing, I mean, the word, the very word, the truth,
mm-hmm.
It is so self-evident. How can it be experienced without being infinite?
No, but infinity has so many grades to it. What the Buddha experienced was also infinite. So whether there is another grade of infinity or not, that he didn't see, you see.
Anyway, I think I can stop here for now. Because these are the things so experiential.
Yeah.
It's kind of difficult to talk about.
Yeah. Also, yeah, I mean, and this is also a very profound thing. I mean, there are grades of infinity. I mean, even mathematically speaking, if you take the entire set of odd numbers, for example, it's an infinity. But it's a partial infinity. So similarly, the experience of infinity
I mean, this that mathematical thing, right? That 1 by 9 is 0.1111, and 1 by 2, I mean, no, I'm sorry, 2 by 9 is 0.222, and so on. And that way, you hit 9 by 9, which is 1, which is ultimately 0.9999. But you still know that there is a difference between 0.9999 and 1. Right? That difference, if you see that, well, mathematically, it equates this way, so you have to accept that equality. I mean, that is one way of thinking, but another way of thinking, well, that is where it is hitting the limitation of mathematics, because you'll have to accept 1 equal to 0.999999. So, it just seems to be that way.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, see, at a certain point, our ignorance kind of stands in the way of understanding anything.
Debash, is there something easier now?
Yeah.
Does Sri Aurobindo make a point as to, see, you're trying to be a yogi in life, not trying to escape life. So does he say that you should turn around and help your fellow beings to also reach this truth that you are seeking, so that we reach a critical mass together for the good of the whole? Or it's just that I try to shoot alone and that itself will have an influence? Basically, does he prioritize these two, or he just says follow your swabhava?
No, he's not saying that you must turn around and help people. What he's saying is that spirituality comes to a point where that becomes possible. See, that whole thing about realization of Brahman, for example, where if you go for Aham Brahmasmi, at a certain point it has to turn around and affirm Tattvamasi. So if that happens, and when that happens, then you're justified in putting out your hand to help others. But before one can have that power to sort of see, of course one can make that one's yoga as well, that I'm trying to help others and thereby see that all is the Brahman or whatever. So, but it's really, you know, only as a spiritual experience that it must proceed, not as an ethical decision, that we should do it because it's good to do it.
And the other thing is that if you yourself are progressing, it has an effect. Is that true?
That I don't know. He doesn't say that anywhere.
Because I know other disciplines say that, suppose you are doing a lot of spiritual exercises, they say that you are actually sitting as if you are creating a ripple in this space of consciousness, and it affects everyone else. So there are these, for example, before the war, a group of Shri Ravi Shankar's people and Sufis, they all meditated so that their good effect would pervade around the world and it would change people's consciousness and the war wouldn't begin. That is the Iraq war. So is there a truth in that?
That I don't know. I have no idea about that. That part seems to me to be more sattvic ego than anything else.
Okay, but then there is a truth in vibrations, right?
So many vibrations are there. What is there to empower these vibrations over anything else? And is one sure that five people meditating are going to produce powerful enough vibrations to counteract all this chaos? I mean, what is the power of these meditators? Meditation is not a trivial thing. Anybody can sit and close their eyes. What does one get out of it? Power of meditation means if you can reach something really high, then perhaps you can radiate some force. See, how many people can reach that height? Just sitting down and meditating or chanting, something like that, is not necessarily going to do anything.
So suppose you are in the overmind, or you are a being, enlightened being, and you meditate for others, that could make a difference.
That I'm not sure. Must make a certain amount of difference. This is exactly the point he's making over here. He's saying that in that case, you can have an influence on the inner nature of the cosmos or of other human beings, etc. But it won't go far enough. You won't have any transformative effect.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for transformation, you have to go beyond the mind, which is, I suppose, the supermind?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that is why you link this part with the three soul forces, where Savitri tells them that she has to go beyond to bring them power to transform.
Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, now I got the right phrase. Shravinda says, I want to know God the way God knows himself.
Yeah, right.
I probably was targeting that has to be, I mean, that must be the initial call of the real truth seeking.
Yeah, that's true. That is, see, even that particular statement, I want to know God as God knows himself, is already arising out of a consciousness that is face to face with the multiplicity of spiritual realizations that people have had. And that itself poses a contradiction. You know, the very fact of history, the history of spirituality, poses a contradiction to mankind, particularly in a world in which you see so many people claiming that I experienced the divine, and their descriptions are totally different. But naturally, they haven't experienced it the way the divine experienced it.
Yeah, so mathematics should not be ignored totally.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Keka, why don't you go ahead?
Another objection to the mystic and his knowledge is urged, not against its effect on upon life, but against his method of the discovery of truth, and against the truth that he discovers. One objection to the method is that it is purely subjective, not true independently of the personal consciousness and its constructions, not verifiable. But this ground of Cavil has no great value. For the object of the mystic is self-knowledge and God-knowledge, and that can only be arrived at by an inward and not by an outward gaze. Or it is the supreme truth of things that he seeks, and that too cannot be arrived at by an outward inquiry through the senses or by any scrutiny or research that founds itself on outsides and surfaces, or by speculation based on the uncertain data of an indirect means of knowledge. It must come by direct vision or contact of the consciousness with the soul and body of the truth itself, or through a knowledge by identity, by the self that becomes one with the self of things and with their truth of power and their truth of essence. But it is urged that the actual result of this method is not one truth common to all. There are great differences. The conclusion suggested is that this knowledge is not truth at all, but a subjective mental formation. But this objection is based on a misunderstanding of the nature of spiritual knowledge. Spiritual truth is a truth of the spirit, not a truth of the intellect, not a mathematical theorem or a logical formula. It is a truth of the infinite, one in an infinite diversity, and it can assume an infinite variety of aspects and formations. In the spiritual evolution, it is inevitable that there should be is everybody on?
Yeah, Keka, we are there.
Sure, we can hear you.
Yeah, sorry. In the spiritual evolution, it is inevitable that there should be a many-sided passage and reaching to the one truth, a many-sided seizing of it. This many-sidedness is the sign of the approach of the soul to a living reality, not to an abstraction or constructed figure of things that can be petrified into a dead or stony formula. The hard logical and intellectual notion of truth as a single idea which all must accept, one idea or system of ideas defeating all other ideas or systems, or a single limited fact or single formula of facts which all must recognize, is an illegitimate transference from the limited truth of the physical field to the much more complex and plastic field of life and mind and spirit.
He doesn't want to be there, you know?
Yeah.
What do you know?
So, here, actually, it's interesting because here, from here on, again, he's drawing attention to this, again, this thing about the evolution of spirituality, which moves towards the truth as experience. So first, he is bringing it up from this viewpoint that is there a verifiability to it? And this is one of the main problems that inaugurates, to some extent, the modern age. To some extent, this was a major, a difficulty with this transition from the medieval age to the modern age in Europe, because the medieval age was marked by the excesses of religion. You know, when you had, particularly towards the end of the medieval age, what are known today as the Dark Ages, you had such things as the Inquisition. And, you know, what was called the indulgences, where some particular privileged human being or group of human beings could dictate on the life of others. It was a rejection of that for something that all human beings could commonly verify that caused the sort of whole entry into the modern age. And this, and one of the things about this verifiability is that the one thing that we share in common is the material substratum. We all use our senses to contact material reality. Therefore, material reality is a common denominator that we can all verify as being real. So it was the seeking for that common source of verification that inaugurates the modern age to some extent. And that's why, in seeking for spiritual experience, the method, which is no longer the method of experimental science, is brought into question. The advantage of the method of experimental science is that it lends itself commonly to verification. It can be reproduced in visible forms by anybody. Now, here you are being told that this is achieved by the individual. Again, if it is an individual, then this is the question that arises: are we not falling back into the problem of the Dark Ages, in the sense of affirming something which is purely subjective? We can't get objective validation for all to affirm. And Sri Aurobindo is saying that essentially the truth of the spirit is not of the nature of the truth of matter. The truth of matter can be verified in an objective form, which is repeatable, distinct, and everybody will have the same kind of facts or data, information from it. But the truth of the spirit is self-evident. It is in the experience of the oneness of things that truth of the spirit is verified. It is not verified by numbers. The verification by numbers may also occur, which is, in a sense, how Vivekananda was pointing out, that yoga is that, you know, whoever is willing to follow the method will arrive at the verification of consciousness in their own lives. But it is not verifiable in the sense that it does not leave external results which are measurable in the same manner. The results that it leaves are verifiable only to the individual. And in its self-evident nature of the experience of oneness, of unity, and of infinity, of the one infinite, it is verified in one's own being. Now, then he moves to the point of the evolution of spirituality and points out how this one experience affords itself or offers itself in a variety of ways to different beings. And there again we find this thing about the various approaches and descriptions of the divine that those who have had some spiritual experience have come up with. Now, there again, what we were discussing recently has some bearing, because the reason that these are different is that the spirit affords, you know, different approaches to human beings, but also partly because these are all prismatic angles on the one truth. The one truth, the infinite being, is many infinities, and each of these infinities can be experienced. It is only when we rise beyond them to the integral truth, the supramental truth, that they are experienced all at once. But what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out is that in the history of mankind, the history of spirituality, it's important that all these various approaches be integrated, that people have a variety of different approaches to the truth in a field of plurality, so that nature may integrate all these experiences in the cosmic being and then arrive at the integral realization. That's the many-sided passage he's talking about.
So do you think that the psychic and the mind, if they can join together, in other words, mind is getting the rasa of the vision of the psychic, and all it wants is to move forward, not define anything.
You see, this idea about union of the mind and the psychic is actually a very profound idea, because that is ultimately how the integral yoga proceeds through two of its transformations. You see, that's why psychic transformation and the cosmic transformation, which is really the acme of the mental realization, are both needed for the access of the supermind. Psychic, if it has its realization and its access to spirituality, it will stop at a certain place, like the Vaishnavas and the Christians and all that kind of thing. Similarly, if the mind rises to higher realms of cosmic consciousness, it will stop at a certain point, like all the various, you know, kind of different schools of Advaita, you may say. But if the two combine and rise to their highest possibility together, then we actually complete two-thirds of the yoga. And at that point, it is absolutely moved to the next stage, which is the supernatural, domain.
But the inherent assumption in that question is also that, I mean, the mind is able to enjoy the psychic, right? It may not be that way at all. It may be more the psychic is using the mind rather than the mind implicitly enjoying the psychic there, isn't it?
Well, as far as enjoyment goes, now the thing is, the cosmic consciousness is something which arises out of the mind. The mind at its height and its acme experiences all forms of all kinds of experiences in the cosmos as shapes and forms of itself. That is a kind of enjoyment. But the meaning of that enjoyment as the one being who has entered into all things belongs to the psychic. And therefore the psychic can push that beyond the borders of the cosmic mind to the realm of the transcendent. See? So that's exactly where you find that the psychic can give to the mind the aspiration that takes it further and further beyond, so that it doesn't stop. See? Otherwise, it can stop at a certain point, affirming a certain infinity to be the whole.
So, Devajit, I mean, while on the topic of on the, so in the earlier chapters of the Life Divine, when he says that the once we get to the inner being, it has easier access to the you know, the general consciousness. Is he talking of the same cosmic consciousness at the heights of the mind?
No, he is talking about the subliminal consciousness. So what he's saying is that Brahman can be experienced at any level of the being, firstly. So if one goes into the inner being, then in a sense one opens the doors to the universal consciousness, either through the mind, vital or subtle physical. And by that can actually receive messages, can enter into a more intimate intercourse with the cosmos. That's the point he's making. But to realize the cosmic mind is quite different from that entry into the universal consciousness through the inner being. See?
Uh-huh.
Experience of cosmic mind, or you may look at it like this, for example, that when we talk about cosmic consciousness, firstly, it's an envelopment. It is something which envelops an entire world. Okay, a universe or a cosmos, right? So it is a consciousness that in that sense includes the whole of the cosmos. Secondly, it is a consciousness that has entered into each of the beings of the cosmos as its determining form. So all forms are actually variations of the cosmic being, waves of the cosmic ocean. You see? So at that level, you find a certain kind of cosmic interchange, a universal interchange between things that are at an inner level. But if we rise to the peaks of the mind, to cosmic mind, what we are experiencing is the envelopment of cosmos as a consciousness. Now that envelopment of cosmos as a consciousness can figure itself to us in a variety of ways. This is the reason why there are different Advaitas, each one of which is giving us a figure of the cosmic consciousness as the Brahman.
Yeah, no, thank you, Devashish.
Devashish, I wanted to clarify that rasa that I said. What I meant was that it's like mind is like a child which is having toys to analyze and describe and all that, and at the same time having the assurance that there will be more in the future or there will be more ahead, and that assurance actually gives that rasa, and that assurance is coming from psychic.
I see. So essentially what you're saying is that it is a special kind of rasa provided by the psychic to the mental, you know, being, in that it opens it to the wonder of the infinite that never ceases.
Exactly, very well.
I think you're breaking up, we can't hear you.
Who is talking now? I cannot hear anything.
No, nobody is saying anything. Nobody has been saying anything.
It's not working.
Hello? What are you doing?
Nothing. I don't know. This transference has been responsible for much harm. It brings into thought narrowness, limitation, and intolerance of the necessary variation and multiplicity of viewpoints, without which there can be no totality of truth finding, and by the narrowness and limitation, much obstinacy in error. It reduces philosophy to an endless maze of sterile disputes. Religion has been invaded. religion has been invaded by this misprisioned and infected with creedal dogmatism, bigotry and intolerance. The truth of the spirit is a truth of being and consciousness and not a truth of thought. Mental ideas can only represent or formulate some process, some mind-translated principle or power of it, or enumerate its aspects. But to know it, one has to grow into it and be it. Without that growing and being, there can be no true spiritual knowledge. The fundamental truth of spiritual experience is one. Its consciousness is one. Everywhere it follows the same general lines and tendencies of awakening and growth into spiritual being. For these are the imperatives of the spiritual consciousness. But also, there are, based on those imperatives, numberless possibilities of variation of experience and expression. The centralization and harmonization of these possibles, but also the intensive soul following out of any line of experience, are both of them necessary movements of the emerging spiritual consciousness force within us. Moreover, the accommodation of mind and life to the spiritual truth, its expression in them, must vary with the mentality of the seeker so long as he has not risen above all need of such accommodation or such limiting expression. It is this mental and vital element which has created the oppositions that still divide spiritual seekers or enter into their differing affirmations of the truth that they experience. This difference and variation is needed for the freedom of spiritual search and spiritual growth. To overpass differences is quite possible, but that is most easily done in pure experience. In mental formulation, the difference must remain until one can exceed mind altogether and in a highest consciousness integralize, unify, and harmonize the many-sided truths of the spirit.
Should we complete the other paragraph or is it a completely different one? It's a short paragraph following this.
Yeah, we completed the other paragraph. So this paragraph follows on the end of the other paragraph. Essentially, he is making a call for plurality of approaches. He's saying that in our journey towards the integral consciousness, both in history and in today's world, it is inevitable that there will be a variety of approaches. Even when there is a single experience, maybe a highest experience, still, so long as the instrument, the mind and the vital, as he says, are not raised up into that single experience, they will have differences of expression. So there are two different things, and they're both very important. One is the fact that, you know, people may experience the same thing, but they will express it differently from different sides and according to their nature and its needs, perhaps in totally different ways. Another thing is that they might actually experience different things, which are different aspects of the one reality. And then naturally the expression will also be different. Now the point he's making is, in the integral knowledge, it's necessary to arrive at the single truth that includes all truths. But it is also necessary to have the ability to move into any specific truth and explore it by itself. So, in the journey of man towards integrality, this plurality has to be affirmed. This is the point he is making. It's very important to allow a variety of expressions of the same thing as a living journey that people undertake towards this goal. Only when that has been sufficiently integrated in time, in the human species, may we come to something which is much more universal in the common experience, in the general experience. Actually, from a certain point of view, this also sort of is related to language. The variety of languages and variety of expressions are necessary in man's growth towards the Supreme. In fact, it's very interesting that in the Bible, or at least in the Old Testament, there is a kind of a myth or a story told about, the city of Babylon, where they wanted to build a tower to heaven. See, so that tower to heaven was attempted to be built by the highest technology available to people at that time. And people of all kinds, with their greatest, aspirations and efforts, skills, set about erecting that tower. When the tower had reached very high, close to the, realms of heaven, as they say, suddenly something happened. And as the Bible puts it, the Supreme Being, sort of brought dissension into these people who were erecting the tower. And that dissension was expressed through what are called the tongues. The Tower of Babel, the story of the Tower of Babel is suddenly, at that very great height, all these people started talking in different languages and they couldn't understand each other. And they fell, into tremendous discord because each one was talking in a language which nobody else could understand. And the tower remained incomplete. See? This is a very profound parable, I feel, of this very factor that so long as we are stuck in the lowest denominator, we all agree about everything. But the higher we go, the greater the differentiation of the one spirit in our experience and expression. And we start speaking what one might call different languages, almost. Now, this is not necessarily a kind of a call for dissension or chaos, but firstly, an attempt has to be made to integrate this differentiation. And it's only in the possibility of this integration that we will rise into the many-sidedness of truth, the integral truth. And when we've integrated it, perhaps we'll arrive at a new language. See, that new language is perhaps the language that humanity doesn't have yet, which one might call supramental language. It is exactly because of that that Sri Aurobindo has said that the highest language available to him, even when he wrote the mantric sort of expression of Savitri, was the language of Ubermind. It is not because the supermind was not available to him, but because the language of the supermind requires a corresponding change of consciousness in those who will receive the language. And that is far from us as yet. So this process of plurality, this process of arriving through freedom to experience the one in a variety of ways, is very necessary to the coming of the supramental age, to the coming of the integral consciousness. And that's the point he's making here, that if that doesn't happen, it's very deplorable. And as he says, it can be responsible for much harm.
Devashish.
Yes, Vince.
The building of the Matra Mandir and all the problems that it involves over the 30 years or so of its construction made me think many times of the Tower of Babel story.
Yeah.
It's true. Finally came to fruition.
Yeah, very true. It's exactly things of this nature that pose the greatest challenge, and they're supposed to pose that challenge. And it really exercises, and that's where exactly as I was saying, and I think Keka was also trying to bring out, that the emergence of the psychic is a very important step in facilitating that harmony, facilitating that mediation between the tongues. Each of the tongues is a perspective on the cosmic. And these tongues are all necessary. But at the same time, there has to arise a certain power that will mediate between them. If that does not arise, then they will fall upon each other and create only disharmony.
What I thought was so interesting was that in spite of all the stress, unbelievable strife, unbelievable disharmony, people persisted and it actually came true. I mean, they actually did build the Mantramandir. It's totally miraculous from a one sense, one perspective, you know, that it actually got done.
It is miraculous, Vince. It actually speaks not so much about human endeavor, but again, back to that one line, one man's perfection yet can save the world. It is the mother's consciousness that made it happen, not the power of humanity to even embody that psychic power, that psychic mediation, but it is the mother's consciousness that made it happen. So too, I think, other disharmony perhaps wait her mediation. But at the same time, I think often she poses a challenge so that we can grow from it as human beings.
Yes, I think that's why there's such a wonderful feeling in the Mantramandir.
Yeah.
When one goes there and sits, it's absolutely amazing, yeah.
One more thing I was thinking in this context is that when you were saying that there should be an attempt of, harmonizing the languages and accepting others or rather validating others' experiences and all that, I think that is one of the probably key aspects why psychic is so necessary, like... Because it understands, I mean, there also, by the way, I mean, it's also an social effort, which is not really coming, not necessarily coming from the psychic, or it is not in its purest form, which sort of tries to socially connect with some kind of moral words or even spiritual moral words, whichever you call, in order to make a construction of harmony, not real harmony. And psychic is something that can understand what is true harmony and what is not. Meaning, if somebody is expressing some kind of experience, psychic actually has that piercing ability of seeing that if it is coming from some kind of sincere source, instead of looking at the expression, the language of expression, it tries to look at the source, and then it actually is intrigued and wonders at it and gets the delight out of looking at that other source. Am I making sense?
Very true. Absolutely. Very true. And I think that's the nature of the true psychic. You're very right. I mean, in fact, it exists for that growth into that infinite wonder in various directions. It has its own sadharma, but it immediately catches the sadharma of others. This is a very important point that Sri Aurobindo makes in that chapter called True and False Subjectivism, where he's saying that to go deep into oneself and affirm one's deeper reality is important. But if one does that in an incomplete way, without arriving at the soul, then one will affirm oneself at the cost of others. But if one does it by arriving at the soul, then one will really enjoy the beauty of every different expression of that same spiritual reality. It's the many-sidedness of the infinite one that will be experienced from that point of view. So arriving there is very important. It's a key factor. And also another important thing is when we talk about the psychic and the emergence of the psychic has to emerge in its fullness. It has to emerge in its integral sense, or at least it has to emerge in a way which affirms both mind and life. What often happens is that the psychic being behind the emotional being fires the emotions, you know, and creates a culture of bhakti, which sometimes becomes narrow and shuts out the reality of the mind. This is not the full emergence of the psychic being. This is only the influence of the psychic being on the emotional being. And that creates problems sometimes. That's the reason why it's much more important to transcend that.
Debashita, can we say the reverse, that in case we are unable to see the truth in something else, that we have really not reached the psychic, or we are not even under the influence of the psychic?
Yeah, we may be under the influence of the psychic, Lupa, but you see, because the influence of the psychic occurs in many planes, in all the planes and parts of the being. So the psychic influence at a certain level can fire that particular aspect of consciousness to make progress. But unless the psychic emerges to some considerable degree in its integrality, this problem will arise, because then only can it actually enjoy or perceive the many-sidedness of truth. Before that, if the psychic influence is there, there is no guarantee that there is going to be that particular awareness. There may be a more narrow kind of approach, to one-sided approach towards the divine from whatever part is influenced by the psychic.
So suppose we have a complete psychic emergence, is there a possibility that we'll see something as really bad, as evil, in essence undivine?
Now what will happen is, as far as that is concerned, this thing about bad or undivine, is that yes, it might be able to see that the struggle for evolution of consciousness is being hampered by certain forces. And whatever is hampering those forces is at a certain level, you may say, of transformation that either can be transformed or cannot be transformed. Actually, the call for whether something is truly evil or not, I don't think is even possible to the psychic. The psychic can stay away from certain things which hurt it or harm it at a certain point. But again, there you have to arrive at not just the psychic, but at the cosmic, which gives values to everything and psychicized, or rather the psychic being in the cosmic.
This power of discrimination, is that not something we need, and that is in the mind, right? It's kind of the most highest
power of
mind.
Discrimination can come also from the psychic. You see, power of discrimination, the psychic power of discrimination begins by helping us to understand what is right for us and what is wrong for us, even before the cosmic part of mind or the mind rises into the higher planes. If the psychic discrimination starts working, it works in an individual way. It's purely individual. It tells you what you need to do and what you don't need to do. It can't be applied to anybody else. But if there is a rise, if there is an opening up of the cosmic planes, then there is a seeing which is more cosmic in nature also. The psychic taking its hand over there can come to understandings of, there is a certain thing that is hampering the movement of the world forces or not. That is the power with which somebody can say that, okay, this particular being, you see, like when mother said that, you know, Asuri power is behind Stalin or behind, Hitler. That is a power which is coming from a cosmic vision of reality and, of course, a transcendental kind of understanding of things. But the psychic discrimination is purely personal. It acts to enable your sadhana. That's what it is there for.
And the discrimination of the buddhi?
Discrimination of the buddhi gradually moves towards a more and more cosmic understanding. It may start off as an individual thing, but it widens into more and more cosmic understanding.
But all these things that we are discussing about knowing what is right and understanding with the psyche is not fully related to whether you must act or not. That comes from another part, right? It comes from, I don't know, maybe Swabhava.
Well, no, but also it is related because discrimination gives us a certain access to action. You know, it tells us how to act. It is there to enable action as well as both inner and outer action. Discrimination tells us what to do. But basically it is there, you know, it, depending on where you are, your discrimination is either entirely individual or it can take on a larger scope.
Well, I thought discrimination was part of the yoga of the Purusha, whereas action is the yoga of the Prakriti.
No, you can't really delimit it like that. Discrimination is also a prakritic thing. You see, discrimination belongs to the nature. There is a place which Sri Aurobindo is saying that intellect is the instrument of nature that is closest to the Purusha. Therefore, it can become an instrument of the Purusha. But that doesn't mean that it is not part of the nature. It is also part of the nature.
So there is a small tagline that is left. Somebody can read, or should we end this chapter?
Let's read it. I think we'll finish the chapter. Yes, I think this was a long chapter,
yeah.
We are right at the end of the chapter. It's almost like the poem by Sri Aurobindo called "The Little More." Anybody remembers that poem?
Yeah, the one step and all is sky and God.
Right.
All right, let's take that one little step.
Let's take that one step.
Yes.
So that little more is the title of the poem?
I think it's One Day.
One Day, right?
One day.
Okay.
You remember that poem, Lopa?
Not the whole thing.
Okay, why
one
didn't
day,
you,
one day and all the half deed is done. One day and all the half, and the not... The half done has, not begun has begun or something like that.
You don't remember?
No, I don't.
Okay, let's finish.
Yeah. Keka, do you want to read?
One second. Yes, I have the collected poems. So,
yeah, find it. It's nice. It's a good point.
Yeah, we found it.
It's a beautiful poem.
I can read it.
If Kika wants to look, I'll read it.
Yeah, it's on page 109.
Page 109. Collected works. Collected poems.
Okay. Page 109. No, because the poem names are here in the index.
109.
I mean, the hard copy just came out, the complete works, collected poems. One day, yeah, got it. 542. All right. 542. 1 second. Almost there. 542. Yes, one day, and there is a subtitle, The Little More. One day, and all the half-dead is done. One day, and all the unborn begun. A little path, and the great goal. A touch that brings the divine whole. Beautiful. hill after hill was climbed, and now, behold, the last tremendous brow and the great rock that none has trod, a step, and all is sky and God.
So shall we take that step now?
Yes, we can take that step. I could read it. In the evolution of the spiritual man, there must necessarily be many stages, and in each stage, a great variety of individual formations of the being, the consciousness, the life, the temperament, the ideas, the character. The nature of instrumental mind and the necessity of dealing with the life must of itself create an infinite variety according to the stage of development and the individuality of the seeker. But apart from that, even the domain of pure spiritual self-realization and self-expression need not be a single white monotone. There can be a great diversity in the fundamental unity. The Supreme Self is one, but the souls of the Self are many. And as is the soul's formation of nature, so will be its spiritual self-expression. A diversity in oneness is the law of the manifestation. The supramental unification and integration must harmonize these diversities, but to abolish them is not the intention of the spirit in nature.
So we see that actually Sri Aurobindo concludes this chapter, the evolution of the spiritual man, by pointing to an immensely varied approach to the divine. It's almost like Sri Ramakrishna's statement, "Jato mot toto pot." Approaches to the divine, so many kinds of divines, Delhi, one may even say. So that many-sidedness has to open up as our approach becomes more concrete. The religion of the past existed to club human beings under great systems. Each of the systems was given, so to say, so that a whole bunch of people could affirm it and have something common to go by. But the closer we come to the emergence of the spiritual man, more diversity there will be in spiritual approaches, and more languages, as it were, will open up of spirit. It is at that point that we must actually move consciously towards seeing the many-sidedness of the one, towards appreciating that. And that is the basis on which we will arrive at a cosmic existence that is the fullness of the emergence of the spiritual man. Beyond that is the next step, which is really the harmonization and integration of this variety by the light and power of the supermind. And that also has to come. But that should not be taken to mean some kind of uniformity that will abolish the many-sidedness of nature. Mm. It will be an inner experience of oneness and variety at the same time. Mm.
Shall we end here with a short meditation?
Yes.